cfrc.ca or on Instagram at CFRC Prison Radio. We look forward to receiving your messages and sharing them over the airwaves.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor, brought to you by Realtor Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Connect with Kim today to find a new home tomorrow via kimpurcell.ca. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer Jesse Bell and CFRC's Arts Coordinator Genevieve Hinch. Our top story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Laurie, covering the future development of three major recreation facilities in the city of Kingston.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca. Three of Kingston's most well-used public facilities could look very different in the years ahead. The city has begun the long-term planning process for Centre 70, the Kingston Memorial Centre, and Portsmouth Olympic Harbour. Together, the three sites host everything from hockey games and the annual fall fair to the Memorial Centre Farmers Market, sailing programs, and community events. Last week, the city's Arts, Recreation, and Community Policies Committee reviewed the first phase of what's being called the Multi-Site Visioning and Recreation Facility Capital Planning Project. This first phase lays the groundwork for what comes next, examining the condition of each property, how residents use them today, and what they want these spaces to become over the coming decades. The Memorial Center was the center of much of the conversation, with decades of effort behind protecting it for community use. Goals for the center include preserving traditions like the fall fair and farmers market, while creating new spaces that allow the site to be active year-round.
Don't think of it as an arena site and park, but this multi-use hub. I think the opportunity exists to create new spaces, new program opportunities for the fall fair. And as it relates to the farmers market, one question I think we're going to look at from a design perspective is whether or not there can be an indoor-outdoor type space that's created, perhaps along one axis of the arena, depending on the configuration of that building itself. So a pretty strong commitment, I think, to coming up with solutions for those two particular groups. And then it would follow that issues around other events in the open space, unstructured use of the park.
One of the biggest proposals in the report is a partnership with Queen's University that could see a new twin pad arena built at the Kingston Memorial Center. The idea would replace aging ice at Centre 70 while also meeting the university's varsity hockey needs. City staff told councillors those discussions are already underway.
That's the next opportunity, is working with Queen's to come up with an arrangement. We expect that there will need to be some capital lease arrangement as well as an operating lease arrangement included in the facility. Of course, Queens will have other needs that are beyond the needs of just a community rink, such as dressing rooms and other training rooms and so on. And those things would all need to be considered within the lease structure. So those are the things that we've started to discuss with them, and that would be a next step.
If that partnership moves forward, it could also shape the future of Centre 70, which is expected to be decommissioned as it currently exists in the next 5 years. The site occupies a large piece of land in Kingston's West End. And while city staff say there are opportunities there, they are still determining what the options are.
It's kind of said we think 5 years could be a timeline before we completely phase out the Centre 70 arena. However, with the with the commitment from Queens to work with us on a partnership and on the leasing arrangement, it may be possible to advance those things should the funding come into place. The Center 70 is an interesting site. Of course, each site is unique, but for Center 70, there could be some other strategic uses for that site coming up, and I'm not able to really articulate what is going to happen at that site at this time or what we're proposing might happen at this time. But through the work in phase two, we'll have a better picture and be able to come back with options for you.
It will ultimately be to council through a series of recommendations to contemplate what the best use of the land at Center 70 would be following a decommissioning exercise. And I think Director Elgersma and the team really want to bring forward not only what the opportunity, but quite frankly, what the cost associated with those opportunities are against the need and a broader landscaped approach to looking at the needs in the west end of Kingston and in considering that site's activation.
All three facilities are aging, and each faces significant investment needs over the next decade. The report estimates more than $25 million in capital requirements at the Kingston Memorial Center, and roughly $19 million at Portsmouth Olympic Harbor, while Center 70 will also require major investment if it is to remain in operation. These facilities continue to serve thousands of residents each year, but they're becoming more difficult and more expensive to maintain. And waiting too long could create challenges beyond higher repair costs.
Just feel it's necessary to put officially on record that the aging infrastructure of these properties cannot be understated, the risk that the city is increasingly taking on. We saw what happens when we lost Center 70's ice, not for reasons of the facility's condition, but actually through a water break. And, you know, if we were to lose the Memorial Center and Center 70, we would be sufficiently depleted in ice in our community. And I raise that because council consideration has to think through, you know, the investment and the phasing. We'll need to consider what would be the greater impact if we were to lose the Memorial Center's ice, for example.
The report also reflects what residents said during public consultations held earlier this year. People consistently asked for flexible community spaces, indoor recreation, walking tracks, wellness facilities, cultural programming, and outdoor gathering spaces. At the same time, many emphasized the importance of preserving the identity of places like the Memorial Center while making them more useful throughout the year. This report will be brought to Council for final approval at their upcoming meeting on Tuesday, July 7th. The project remains in its early stages. There are no final designs, approved construction timelines, or detailed cost estimates. Those pieces will come during phase two, when concepts are refined and options are brought back for public discussion and council consideration. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. Coming up next, we have Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for The Kingstonist, Michelle Dory Forestell, about staffing issues on the Wolf Island Ferry.
Thank you, Jesse. Hundreds of travelers were once again left stranded last weekend after the Wolf Island Ferry was taken out of service for nearly 6 hours because of a crew shortage, disrupting the only transportation link between the island and mainland during one of the busiest weekends of the summer. The interruption began shortly after 8:30 a.m. sailing from Wolf Island on Saturday, June 27th, when the Ministry of Transportation announced service was suspended because of a shortage of crew members. Service resumed at approximately 2:30 p.m. The Wolf Island Ferry is the only year-round connection for the island's roughly 1,600 residents, while also carrying thousands of tourists and seasonal visitors during the summer months. The MTO said the interruption was caused by a crew shortage. Saturday's suspension was another chapter in the Wolf Island Ferry's long-running reliability problems. Over the past several years, residents have endured repeated service interruptions caused by everything from mechanical breakdowns to staffing shortages, with each disruption renewing questions about the province's management of the island's only year-round transportation link. The shutdown prompted an immediate response from OPSU Local 428, their union representing workers on Wolf Island, Amherst Island, and Glenora Ferry Services. In a news release issued Saturday, June 27th, the union argued the disruption was the predictable result of years of understaffing. The union said it has warned the Ministry of Transportation in recent years that staffing levels have become increasingly fragile. According to the union, staffing levels have declined over the past decade, even as ferry schedules have expanded to meet growing demand. The union also pointed to another service interruption on June 15th, which, it said, occurred after another employee called in sick. The ministry has not publicly responded to the union's broader allegations regarding staffing levels. The weekend disruption was followed by another service interruption Monday, June 29th, although under different circumstances. The MTO advised passengers via its social media channels that ferry service was temporarily delayed due to a medical emergency. Service later resumed. While unrelated to the earlier crew shortage, the second interruption highlighted the importance of maintaining reliable ferry service for island residents, commuters, and visitors who depend on the route every day.
Thank you to Dinah Jansen and Michelle Dory Forestell for that story. Coming up next, we have a story from Brenda Little, LGI reporter for CJPE County FM, about a reconciliation event being held at the Picton Library.
June is Indigenous Heritage Month, and the Picton Library in Prince Edward County hosted a discussion with authors Derek Aronhi Nance Montour and Ellen Sandberg Miller, where they talked about their book Everyday Reconciliation, A Guide to Action and Change for All of Us. Two very different perspectives. Derek is of Indigenous background, and Elin is a Swedish immigrant who became interested in Canada's Indigenous history, resulting in her podcast, Everyday Reconciliation. I spoke with Elin and Derek about the book and steps one can take toward their own reconciliation journey. Elin, you are from Sweden. What fascinated you about Indigenous history here?
Well, when I moved to Canada with my Canadian husband and young children in 2008, I thought I was coming to a country known for its multiculturalism, its human rights, its inclusion and diversity, and in many ways that is exactly what Canada stands for and what it is. But we settled in Montreal, where my husband is from, and so I discovered that there were First Nation reserves outside of Montreal, both Ganawage, where Derek is from, and Ganasatog on the other side. And I was really surprised, because that meant that people lived segregated under different rules and under very different conditions, and I just thought that was, you know, a thing of the past and not something that I would find in Canada. So that triggered my learning journey.
And Derek, you've come from quite an interesting past, a mix. Your mother was from Glasgow, and so your father would have been Indigenous. How do you think we can reconcile every day? What small things do you think we can do every day to try and help our own reconciliation?
I'll be honest, that for me, the most important thing that non-Indigenous people can do is to start educating themselves. A big challenge is that our system has been designed to not tell the truth, and so whether it's at primary grades or high school or not, or us who are now older, we were never given the truth. So a big part is learning, and starting every day of learning something new. Start with the people that are around you or close, and then start branching out further from there. Try to understand, why are there over 630 different communities? How many nations are there? What about the language groups? You know, an easy example is Canada often is pride, has a lot of pride for that we're two official languages. But the reality is they're two official European languages. And there's nothing embedded to actually learn any of the words or languages of the people where we live. Start with that. Learn some basic words within it. Being able to say nyawa or thank you to somebody who is Kanyakahaga makes a big difference, you know, because that's about relationships. That's about relationship building. So educate yourself and then not be shy to start getting involved, you know, asking questions. If you work in a business, invite Indigenous people in or figure out how to partner. Purchase things from Indigenous business owners. When you're seeking, you know, we often give gifts or give things. Look for Indigenous businesses to try to do that, you know. And the more we can add to that, even something as simple when we go on music and we go on YouTube or others, look for Indigenous artists, you know. That starts raising their profile, and it, you know, it pops up on other people's view. And I think that's the thing is it's what we put value on. And in life, we start valuing things. We'll put value on Indigenous as well. Final comment would be is when we think of culture of Canada, what comes to mind? All people, all settlers come from all parts of the world and they bring their cultures here. And that's a beautiful thing. And they carry their cultures with you. But our culture was suppressed. Our language was suppressed. Help us bring that culture back, because that truly is the culture of this land, is our nations. You know, help us bring that back.
Thank you.
For the Local Journalism Initiative, frequencynews.ca and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
Thank you to Brenda Little for that story. Coming up next, we have the sports report brought to you by CFRC Power Plays. This is Jesse Bell with your sports report brought to you by CFRC Power Plays. And today we are once again taking a look at the NBA offseason, including a massive trade involving the Toronto Raptors. The Charlotte Hornets continue to trade off some of their key young core, sending forward Miles Bridges along with a 2029 first and 2027 second round pick to the Phoenix Suns in exchange for Grayson Allen, Royce O'Neal, and a 2033 first round pick. For the Hornets, who also traded star point guard LaMelo Ball last week, this is a confirmation that they plan on building their team around their forward duo of Brandon Miller and Con Knupel. The Memphis Grizzlies and Portland Trail Blazers have agreed to terms on a trade centered around Memphis's star point guard Ja Morant. Morant, a former Rookie of the Year, has suffered a number of injuries and suspensions over the last three seasons, drastically decreasing his trade value. As such, the Memphis haul is much smaller than what it would have been, say, 2 years ago. Memphis does get two solid forwards in Grant and Murray, but if things work out for the Trailblazers and Morant returns to his all-star form, they may have a perfect pairing alongside veteran point guard Damian Lillard. A blockbuster trade involving the Toronto Raptors was made, as the Raptors sent forward Brandon Ingram, guard Grady Dick, two first-round picks, two second-round picks, and a first-round pick swap to the Los Angeles Clippers in exchange for Kawhi Leonard. Leonard last played for the Raptors in 2019, leading the squad to, so far, their only NBA title in franchise history. Kawhi is coming off one of his better and healthier seasons in 2026, putting up 27 points a game while also providing elite defensive ability. This is a high-risk, high-reward deal for the Toronto Raptors. Let's look at some of the pros and potential cons at play here. One of the big pros for the Raptors is the obvious upgrade from Brandon Ingram to Kawhi Leonard. Ingram underperformed, especially in the 2026 playoffs, and the Raptors also give Grady Dick a fresh start. Dick looked promising in his rookie season, but hasn't lived up to that potential since. Now, when Kawhi Leonard is healthy, the Raptors will have a top 10, arguably top 5 player on their roster, but health has not been a strong point over the last couple seasons for Leonard. When he's in the lineup, he will form one of the most defensively versatile front courts in the NBA alongside Scottie Barnes and Colin Murray-Boyles. That's when he's healthy. It's also worth noting that Kawhi Leonard could be facing possible discipline from the NBA for his role in the Aspiration tree planting scandal. To make a very long story short, Leonard was essentially given a no-show job with a charitable organization as a way to circumvent the NBA salary cap by the Clippers owner, Steve Ballmer. Now, it's more likely that the NBA will focus their discipline on the Clippers organization rather than Kawhi Leonard, but nothing is a guarantee. The last time Leonard played for the Raptors, he was integral in taking home the franchise's first, and so far only, NBA title. Can he rekindle that 2019 magic? Or will the Raptors find themselves in a Brooklyn Nets-type situation where they make a massive trade involving a number of future draft picks for a superstar, only for that superstar to barely play? And worth noting, he's only on a one-year deal. Leave the organization again. It's high risk, high reward. This trade will either make the Raptors or break the Raptors. That's a wrap for your sports report brought to you by CFRC Power Plays. Coming up next, your traffic and weather reports for the Kingston region.
And thank you to Jesse Bell for that update. And also thank you to our sponsor. Today's edition of The Corridor is brought to you by Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Learn more about Kim and local listings for your new home via kimpurcell.ca. Coming up, we have the CFRC Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Wednesday, July 8th, 26 is your high, and because of the cloudy conditions, it's going to feel like 26, UV index only of 6, dropping down to 18 overnight. Thursday, July 9th, 27 is your high with a mix of sun and cloud in the morning, becoming more cloudy into the afternoon. There is a possibility of rain, but it's only hovering around 17%, so it looks like it'll be another dry day here in the city of Kingston. Friday, July 10th, 27 is your high, feeling like 28 with the clear conditions in the forecast. A very sunny day here in the city of Kingston. Perfect start to your weekend. Saturday, July 11th, 26 is your high, feeling closer to 29. A few clouds in the sky, but largely sunny conditions, dropping down to 18 overnight. Sunday, July 12th, a beautiful, crisp, bright sunny day here in the city of Kingston, feeling closer to 30, UV index of 9, dropping down to 18 overnight. And then starting off next week, Monday, July 13th, 25, cloudy with a 55% chance of precipitation. It will be quite humid, feeling closer to 29 degrees, factoring in the humidity. Over to Genevieve Hinch with CFRC's concert and events calendar for the week.
Hello, Kingston, and welcome back to CFRC 101.9 FM. Broadcasting from Kingston, Ontario, I'm CFRC's Community News and Arts Coordinator, Jenny, and this is your weekly events and concerts calendar brought to you by Flying V Productions. Whether you're looking for live music, community events, workshops, markets, or family-friendly activities, there is plenty of happening in Kingston this week, so let's get into it. Tuesday offers a few unique activities, including ASL Workshop on Sydenham Street and Teddy Bear Hospital at the Central Library, where kids can bring their favorite stuffed animals to learn about healthcare in a fun, hands-on way. Salsa in the Square also returns to Springer Market Square with music from Los Garcia, while the evening features Bill Kirchin performing at the Pros and Cons Benefit on Wolf Island. Wednesday features a creative mix of activities around the city, including the Solar Punk Writing Lab at Calvin Park Library and Games in the Square downtown. Music lovers can catch the Limestone Jazz Collective as part of the Swinging Summer Concert Series at City Hall, along with performances by Jay Harris at Spacer's Dockside and Arm's Length, Mile End, and Meathead at the Broom Factory. Thursday marks the start of the Kingston Buskers Rendezvous, filling downtown streets with buskers and performers throughout the weekend. Families can also enjoy stories in the square, while the evening includes drag bingo at Daff Brewery and Buddhist meditation classes at the Sphere. Live music highlights include Mo Kenny at the Broom Factory, Matthew Holtby, Lane Rodsep, and Daniel Raymond at Musiki, and Queer Kong at Hotel Wolf Island. Friday brings plenty to explore with the Buskers Rendezvous continuing downtown and a quick and cute card-making and scrapbooking workshop at the Ted Center. In the evening, Kicking It Country takes over the City Hall atmosphere, while music fans can catch In the Key of Blue at the Isabel Bader Center. Tim Baker at the Hayloft Dance Hall, The Oreos at the Waterfront, and Violet Archers with Hugh Christopher Brown on Wolf Island. Heading into Saturday, the Busker Rendezvous continues along the Saturday Session Concert Series in Confederation Park. Other highlights include the Mending Way Clinic at Cultivate Arts Common, the Napanee Country Jamboree, Tunes in the Tower featuring Kevin and the Kitchen Sink at Murney Tower, and another performance in the Key of Blue. Live music also includes Who's Here at Spicer's Dockside, Jason Kent at the Cove Inn, and Ginny and Rearrangers with Squid Pistol at Overtime Sports Bar. Wrapping things up, Sunday, the Memorial Center Farmers Market returns from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m., while the final day of the Kingston Buskers Rendezvous continues downtown. Music includes the afternoon performance of In the Key of Blue, Head Over Heels at the Cove Inn. That's your weekly events and concert calendar for July 6th through the 12th. And for more information on any of these events, visit the CFRC website and keep it locked right here on CFRC 101.9 FM. This is your events calendar brought to you by Flying V Productions, bringing live theater, comedy, and unforgettable entertainment to audiences across Kingston. Be sure to check out their up-and-coming shows and events through the season. I'm Jenny. Thanks for listening, and have a great week, Kingston.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Hey, 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 this is Disco Rick. Got a brand new show, Dance Floor Dispatch. We're going to be playing all the best house, electronic, and obviously we're going to be playing some disco. It's every Saturday night at 10 p.m. Tune in at CFRC 101.9.
Hi, this is Allison Crow, and you are listening to CFRC Kingston 101.9.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present Combinations, a fully self-produced one-man band release from Plune. Written, performed, and produced entirely by the artist, the track blends the experimental spirit of Beck with a raw, stripped-down folk rock edge reminiscent of Neil Young. Learn more about the artist and keep up with the latest by following them at Plune Music on Instagram. And if you're a local musician who would like airplay and social media coverage on our channels, complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit Kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Combinations by Plune on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
is a rebroadcast. Please disregard any reference to dates or times. Welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, and CFRC. So a big thank you to both of them. If you miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It's a great way to stay informed about all the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are working on. And today, I would like to introduce you to Anna Smythe, who's doing an MA in Classics and Archaeology under the supervision of Dr. Jean-Mathieu Carbon and Dr. Barbara Reeves. Welcome to Grad Chat, Anna.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for coming, especially on a chilly morning like this.
Not cold to my standards.
Okay.
I appreciate it nonetheless.
And your research topic looks at two case studies in ancient Greek everyday writing, potentially written by subordinate people. Can you tell us a little bit more about your topic and give us a bit of an overview of your topic?
For sure. So what I mean by everyday writing is basically I'm trying to look at mediums that are a bit more accessible. Mm. So everyday writing examples can be things like letters or graffiti or curse tablets, which don't sound immediately accessible, but they're a lot more common than you would think in ancient Greece and Rome. It's anything like that anyone could have written, right? Because if they had the literacy to do so, they would have the accessibility to the materials and, in theory, the knowledge of how to format that specific piece of writing because they were decently widespread. Mm. So my two case studies are the collection of Attic Herders graffiti that was found by Dr. Merle Langdon. They're, if you go to visit them today, they're on the outskirts of Athens in a very empty kind of outside of suburbia area on a bunch of hills that are terrible to navigate because of the prickly oak. And they date to approximately the Archaic period, which is just before the Classical period. So we're looking at the 7th and 6th centuries BCE, approximately. And I'm also looking at the Dodona oracular tablets. These are inscriptions written on little lead tablets in Greek. They date from approximately the 6th to the 2nd centuries BCE, so a very wide range. Mm-hmm. And there's thousands of them.
Wow.
I know, it's crazy.
That's a lot for a classic scholar.
Yeah, I'm not looking at all of them. I'm getting loud. I have a selection of them. I'm looking at about 16 of them in total. But within those tablets, there are inscriptions potentially written by subordinate people, which we don't find very often. Mm-hmm. And the Attic Herders graffiti are so named because they're rock-cut graffiti potentially written by herders. And identifying who's written both of these is difficult and can never be certain.
Of course, yes.
But there are indications in both that suggest they were written by subordinate people, herders specifically for the graffiti. Mm-hmm. And specifically within the tablets I'm looking at to compare as much as I can to the Attic Herders graffiti, one's potentially written by herders. And I'm also looking at ones potentially written by enslaved people because there is so little that we have that survived written by enslaved people in ancient Greece. And this was a phenomenal opportunity to be able to examine a group of them from the same context. And of course, that spans a couple decades. And the ones I'm looking at go from approximately the 6th to the 4th centuries BCE. But you don't normally find them grouped together. And so that was my thorough path into being able to try and study potentially direct voices from the past of subordinate people.
Wow, that sounds really exciting, because like you said, there's so few things, and even in more modern circumstances, there's so few things from subordinate people. Mm-hmm. So that's very exciting that you've identified two different areas that you can research on, two different groups of people that span this period, and to give you some comparison and to pull out some big themes. So mm-hmm. how are you analyzing these collections?
So I'm doing it in kind of a piecemeal way, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. Any kind of analysis of anything that's potentially written by subordinate people warrants a lot of caution, mm-hmm. because our record, the classical record, is predominantly written by wealthy male slaveholders. Mm-hmm. So especially in the case of enslaved people, we have to be very, very, very careful that we don't, if there are primary voices in front of us, muddle that with modern interpretation. Mm. And of course, that applies as well to herders and to other folks of lower socioeconomic status. But keeping that in mind, I'm examining the text that survives, which can be difficult because these... especially in the case of the lead tablets, the Dodona tablets, a lot of them have been folded, and so they've been unfolded to examine them, resulting in cracks, and sometimes the writing has smudged or been pressed down so it's very faint, and sometimes there's chunks of a tablet missing, and we don't know how much is missing because it breaks off at what we have now as an edge.
Of course.
And the same happens with the graffiti, in that they've been exposed to the elements for centuries. Yeah. So they can be quite hard to read because they're so faint now and hard to find. Mm-hmm. And so I'm looking at what survives of the text to try and figure out, okay, what's the purpose of this text? Why did the author write this? Was it actually written by an enslaved person or a herder? How can we tell that? How can we argue this? How certain is that argument? Mm. And then I'll be looking at things like, are there any connections in what they're talking about? So are they talking about wanting freedom? Are they talking about cows? There's an assortment of topics that we find in the tablets. And I'm also examining the tablets and the graffiti through a paleographic lens, which is the study of ancient writing. This is where my research is somewhat innovative, because to my knowledge at least, no one has tried to examine sources from subordinate people via their paleography. So I'd be looking at things like handwriting, errors in the text, like spelling errors, grammatical errors, and in general, how the text is aligned on the tablet. And I'm doing so to see if I can identify any sociolinguistic indicators of status. Mm-hmm. My current theory is that I will not be able to. And so far, I have not been able to, which is phenomenal, because then I get to say, we all can assume that this group of people is diverse. Mm-hmm. And here is... yeah, I can accurately say that yes, at least in the ones that I'm looking at, they are diverse in their literacy, in how they pen their tablets, in how they inscribe graffiti, so on and so forth.
Oh, that's really interesting. So it sounds like you're doing a lot in this project, and many different things, many approaches, lots of different sources in the selections you've made. And it sounds like you're making quite an intervention as well and looking at some different things. So why is epigraphy, or this everyday writing, so important to the study of subordinate people in antiquity and especially pre-Hellenistic Greece? And I think you've touched on this a little bit, but what does it do for the field and for us and in general?
For sure. I have touched on it a little bit, but I always love to expand upon
it. Yes, of course.
Because more people should study epigraphy. Maybe I'm biased on that, but epigraphy is one of the fields in classics that's continually revealing new information about the ancient world. It's hard to do that in our literary sources. A lot of our literary works survive in papyrus, which predominantly comes from Egypt, and normally does not date before the Hellenistic period. Mm. I don't know of a single instance of papyrus from before the Hellenistic period. And so when you're trying to learn about ancient Greece or Rome before, you know, 323 BCE, it's difficult if you're looking only through written word, not through epigraphy. Epigraphy is the exception to that, because it survives, not amazingly, but it does survive
yes.
sometimes mm-hmm. on less perishable material like lead or rock. Also, you can find it on pottery as well, though the lines blur between disciplines at that point.
Mm-hmm.
It might actually be papyrology at that point, because if it's painted on a potsherd, is that not like painting on papyrus? I think the distinctions don't matter personally in that case, but that's where it gets a bit blurry. So looking at epigraphy can reveal sources of information and information in general that we don't have through the literary record or even through the archaeological record. The literary record has the benefit of being more informative more easily because we can look at the words and be like, okay, it says this.
Mm-hmm.
There's, of course, nuance in what are the biases of the author. Does this word mean which of 17 definitions that it could be in this context?
Mm-hmm.
Are there dialect stuff that we have to look out for? But it's hard to do that kind of interpretation in archaeology, for example, because you don't have written explanations of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So if you find a group of loom weights in a room in what you think is a house, for example, can you say, okay, I think this room was specifically used to weave? It's possible, but hard to argue.
Mm-hmm.
It could be that the person who owned this house just felt like throwing their loom weights out in this room.
Yeah, just like we do, right? You just throw your gym bag in the corner for storage. Maybe you throw loom weights in the corner for storage, too, until you go back to weaving.
Exactly, exactly. So it's hard to interpret anything. Well, you have to do it by comparing material, of course. And that's when you bring in the literary record when you're analyzing stuff archaeologically to support your analysis and try and fill the holes in the information in front of you. And epigraphy is a nice middle ground between the two, where you have a material source that has come from likely an archaeological context, but it also has writing on it. And so, for example, you can use inscriptions to identify the owners of a house at one point in time. It might say, like, you know, Julia and Philip, and then give a date under perhaps a statue that was in the house or maybe above a threshold somewhere. And you can then say, okay, very likely Julia and Philip owned or at least lived in this house from this point to this point. Great. Beautiful. So epigraphy can help contextualize finds from archaeology and from our literary sources. And both archaeology and our literary sources are almost bereft of direct voices from subordinate people.
Mm-hmm.
You can use the literary record to gain some information about maybe what it would have been like to live as a subordinate person in ancient Greece. But it's very, very difficult because more often than not, our authors are the elite people that are oppressing these subordinate people. And so we have to be very careful. So especially when doing subordinate studies in classics, epigraphy is very important as one of the few potential windows in directly into the lived experience of subordinate people.
And where does subordinate studies in the field of classics and archaeology currently fit? Like, what's the significance of it in the field?
So classics and archaeology is a field with a very colonialist history. It started with Europeans believing that Rome and Greece were the ideal societies and that they, as imperial powers, should emulate Rome and Greece in their heydays, I'm using air quotes here, of their imperial powers. So especially they'd look at Athens' empire or Rome's empire to justify and model themselves after those imperialist tendencies and conquerings. So at the beginning, the field focused almost entirely on the literary aspect of Greece and of Rome, and it was not great, in my opinion, at least. So now in the modern day, because classics, Greece and Rome, are so influential in popular culture still. For example, we had the Gladiator movie, the sequel, come out recently. There's an Odyssey movie coming up very, very soon. It still pervades modern thought. And some of the biases from Greece and from Rome, and also from how our field started, still pervade. So the especially thought of like West versus East in Greece's wars against Persia to justify Western ideas of democracy versus Islam, especially. Mm. Islamophobia is rampant in our field's past. And so studying subordinate studies now is a way to advance the field, to learn more about antiquity, to help us better understand how we got to where we are as people who live in North America and more broadly the Western, with air quotes, world in general, by modeling ourselves off of these two countries. Mm. And it can help challenge our modern biases as well. And you can't do that without challenging Roman and Greek biases, ancient ones, from the authors that have survived. And so subordinate studies is a way to do that and to learn more about especially the darker sides of Greece and of Rome, and to get a better, more well-rounded understanding of those countries, civilizations, and to get a better understanding of our own as well. Mm. So that's why I think it's important.
No, it sounds, it's incredibly important, right? You're getting this, like you so eloquently said, this fuller picture of the past, but also seeing those echoes in the present and understanding, you know, where the field has gone and how it follows kind of the flows and influences of the current day and how you see those reflected back in the past and forward. So that's, I think, very important. Yeah. And you mentioned that you've got these two case studies, the Attic Herder's Graffiti and the Dodona Oracular Tablets. Why did you choose these two case studies in particular?
So because I'm looking at my material through a paleographic lens, it involves a lot of comparison between the tablets and between the graffiti. So I can't accurately compare Herder's Graffiti to Herder's Tablets, at least with any certainty, because they are two different media in two different parts of Greece and it potentially centuries apart, depending on when my tablets are dating to. So I chose them because they had a large enough corpus size that I could do that internal comparison. I'd be comparing the tablets potentially written by enslaved people with tablets potentially written by enslaved people to try and see if there was anything within that context that those tablets share that can indicate differences or similarities. So I needed to have a corpus size large enough to be able to do those comparisons without having very unreliable results. And these two source types, the Herder's Graffiti and the Dodona Oracular Tablets, are like pretty well the only ones I could find in ancient Greek from ancient Greece that were large enough to fit my standards. Even then, they're not very large. And there's, of course, difficulties of identifying authors in both of them, especially for the tablets. I'm sure there are more tablets written by enslaved people that we simply cannot identify because there's no surviving indicators that they were enslaved. Maybe they're not talking about wanting to be free. Maybe they're asking a question about a trial that's coming up or about their home life. We wouldn't be able to know that they're enslaved. So the only tablets I can look at are the ones that either identify something about enslavement or, and this is where it gets a little bit more uncertain, contain the name of the person who is likely writing the tablet, and that name is attested elsewhere as most often or always in what we have that's survived belonging to an enslaved person.
Okay, yeah.
And it's the same with the Herders. Pretty well all of my tablets that are potentially written by Herders talk about animals. Cows, sheep, that kind of thing. And some of them talk about pasturage and things like that. But there are very likely more tablets that were written by Herders that I just simply cannot identify. And for the Herder's Graffiti, they are identified as such because of the longer extant graffiti that we have. Sometimes they will, the authors will identify themselves as Herders. Oh, that's beautiful. It's probably unlikely that they're lying. That's not the simplest answer. So if we go Occam's razor, it's very likely that they were indeed Herders. And also, there's nothing around that area. I've been there. There's nothing. So the water's nearby and we're on a hill in the countryside, but there's no temples around. There's no architecture that's survived. It's just hills. So the prevailing theory is that, well, who would have reason to go to an area of just hills, and that's, well, potentially Herders.
Yes, and then if they call themselves a Herder, even better, right?
Exactly.
Confirmed. And So you mentioned you visit some of these places. So are your case study selections, are they, well, like the graffitis in on site, mm-hmm. but are your other, your Dodona oracular tablets, do you have to visit those in person as well? And what does that process look like?
Great question. So I needed to autopsy or to examine both of these sources in person because of my stipulation on paleography. Mm-hmm. I need to find the grittiness
yes.
of the writing or I will have no substance to my mm. arguments. This is furthered in that both of them were only published in sketch form.
Okay.
So the archaeologists and the professors who first recorded and analyzed and published these pieces of writing didn't do so with photographs, mm. which makes it harder to analyze the paleography, and especially in the case of the Dodona tablets, where there are over 4,000 inscriptions
wow.
that these archaeologists had to go through, and quite frankly, some of them are really hard to read, mm. as I learned when I was there. I wanted to go through with my own eyes to just see what the differences between the sketches published were versus when I was actually looking mm-hmm. at the text. I'm also new to epigraphy, so I wanted the experience as well so that I could better understand the process of making sketches mm. and be able to more critically analyze how sketches are made and how they're published so that I can go in with my own knowledge to make my assessments that way as well. So the Herder's graffiti are indeed in situ. Mm-hmm. They're on site because they're on the ground.
Of course, yes.
And I was able to go there with the help of Dr. Stella Scalza, who was through so kind in offering to take me in her car to this area. And we spent probably a good 4 to 6 hours romping around the attic countryside trying to find these mm-hmm. graffiti. I had communicated with Merle Langdon, who very kindly gave me an approximate location for the two pieces of graffiti that I was going to look at. I didn't, unfortunately, have time or the resources to mm-hmm. find more than that, mm-hmm. as evidenced by how it took me 6 hours yes. to find the second one. So I had an aerial photo, and I had a map, and then I had Google Maps open on my phone. And so we were walking around the hill being like, I think we're almost there. And we managed to find them. The sun had indeed set by the time
oh my goodness.
We found the second one. But it's okay. We found them in the end. And so with her very, very gracious help and patience, we managed to find what we were looking for. And then for the tablets, they are currently housed in the Archaeological Museum of Yenina. And with the very gracious permission of the Greek Ministry of Culture and Sport and the effort of antiquities at mm. Yenina, I was able to go to Yenina, mm. which is in northern Greece, and examine these tablets firsthand. They're currently stored in the museum, the mm. Archaeological Museum of Yenina. And so I was sat in their basement doing my best to examine tablets for the first time. This was before I did the graffiti. Mm. And so it was a lot of me looking at the lead tablets under a microscope going, oh, God, why did three people write over each other on this tablet? And why didn't they think of me, the student 2,000 years in the future who's going to be trying to read this? I'm joking.
Of course, yeah.
It was tempting to think that way sometimes, but I, of course, stay impartial as an academic and manage to eventually read all of them as best that I could.
Mm.
So that was a very long-winded answer to your question.
No, but it's interesting, right, to see how people approach different sources. And these mm-hmm. are very unique source types, again, of likely subordinate people
yeah.
and in two different places. And even though they're both in situ, held in very different contexts as well. You've
yeah.
got an outdoor site that you have to navigate. And then you have a museum site, which you also have to negotiate, right, to get mm-hmm. access. So they're very different ways to access these
yeah.
these two case studies that you're working on. So mm-hmm. thank you for telling us about that. How do you keep notes on all of these things? Are you allowed to photograph anything?
Are yeah.
You mentioned sketches. Do you have time mm-hmm. to make sketches of everything? What does that look like?
I've made sketches of all of the pieces that I've looked at. Mm. I'm currently in the process of editing the ones for the tablets in particular, because my idea with doing the sketches is to better define what I was seeing in the mm. photographs, because quite frankly, even with my photographs, which I think turned out pretty well for the most part, it is still hard to read what's on those tablets. Mm. And the way they were published in the original corpus, the DVC is normally how it's abbreviated in 2013, is that the archaeologists that published these sketches did so where there was one sketch per inscription on the tablet. Mm. So for tablets that were palimpsests, so overwritten quite often, with maybe like 4 to 7 different inscriptions on them, they published 4 to 7 different sketches where they isolated that one inscription and then did the same for all the rest, which is phenomenal when you're trying to read the tablets because, oh, man.
Gives you a little bit of a roadmap to start from.
But as a result, those sketches were meant to elucidate the Greek on the tablet, and so they sometimes didn't contain the grittiness that I was looking for my particular studies. So I was like, okay, in that case, I'll sketch the tablet as it is. I'm not doing multiple sketches. Those already exist. I'll put them all over top of each other. Great. And I did that, and I did it all in the same color, and then I went, I can't read this. So now I'm going back through, and I'm making the different inscriptions different colors so that you can distinguish them between each other while also still being able to tell what's going on. Because keeping them the same color lost the information of what inscription was more clearly defined, what was fainter because it was older and had been worn down a bit more, what was penned in a different way so this one looks sharper, maybe it was written with a point, whereas the other one looks a bit more blunt. That information was lost when I made that sketch, as I did initially. And for the graffiti, my sketches so far look very, very similar to what Dr. Merle Langdon has published. So the graffiti then has both survived a bit better than the Dodona tablets, which sometimes a piece has fallen off now. So you're missing a couple letters here and there. But at the same time, the graffiti is still hard to read, and very little of it has actually been published. So I did find some like personal names strewn around in the same context, in the same area, as the graffiti that I was graffito that I was initially setting out to examine. So my sketches include whatever's around it in the proximity, just to say, in context, this is what's around.
Yeah.
Because when I'm examining graffiti, the benefit of it being in situ is I get to say, here's the context, and here's why I think this graffiti is clustered in this way, or here's why I think it's in this area, which is probably not going to have anything good on it, if I'm being honest, because it's all just rock and brush, and who knows how the landscape has changed since that these graffiti were written. But yeah, so yes, I've made sketches. I also took photographs, and I have permission to publish the photographs of the tablets.
Exciting,
so that's beautiful. And I again thank everyone in Greece for giving me a chance to do this. So there should be some photos in my thesis once it is done.
Oh, that's very exciting. Yes, no, that's great that you've got permission, because sometimes you can look at things for scholarship, but they have to stay, you know, with the right stay with whatever institution is hosting those those sources. So that is very kind of them. That's great to see. Yeah. Well, Anna, it has been so great chatting with you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, and the best of luck with the rest of your research.
Thanks so much for having me. I had a lot of fun.
So that is it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just search Grad Chat. Until next week, this is KM on the FM.
CFRC is stoked to partner with KPP Concerts on an awesome summer lineup. On June 27th, be sure to catch Long Range Hustle and Psychobilly Legends Reverend Horton Heat on June 28th. On July 3rd, check out alt-country legend Fred Eaglesmith, followed by folk punk legend Billy Bragg on July 5th. Emo is alive and well on July 8th with Arms Length and Mo Kenny come to town on July 9th. Hip-hop pioneer Souls of Mischief are here on July 21st, and we'll get some hardcore action with Spaced on July 23rd. Amen Monica brings Arabic Jazz to Kingston on August 7th, and finally, August 9th, you can see Lucero Ben Nichols. For tickets and full information on these and other awesome shows, visit kppconcerts.com.
Tanya Dohaskigo, then on Zewa Dahusa Dache, Ungahuan, and Hadiwa Nodas, and the Aboriginal Voices, Oscar Dewa Nyawar Oscar, Ne Jota FM, CFRC.
It is 6 o'clock, and you're tuned to CFRC 101.9 FM. We're broadcasting from Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario, Canada. On E, Nich Kimek, Doug Farquhar, Disney Cause, Minwa Sean Story, Esna Minwa, and Ishnabi.